meow. Woof, woof. This is the Freedom Fiends, broadcasting from High Bay 2A, a mile above sea level at Intergalactic Prairie Studios. We alter your locus coeruleus by warming your synapses with rejuvenative radio waves. This warms your brain to a tasty and toasty 365 degrees Fahrenheit to keep a sin flood of statism out of your head. Can you feel it, Lou? Is it working? Can you feel it? Yes, I can. Freedom Fiends is covered by a BIPCOT no government license. This allows reuse by anyone except governments. Learn more at BIPCOT.org. So, going to do something a little bit different tonight. I am flying solo, but I am going to pretend that Nick is doing the show with me. He can't be here tonight because he may be caught up in a little thing going on out there in the Pacific Northwest. Not really sure what it's called yet. I'm not sure if it's Ormageddon or Oregeddon or Oramageddon. I don't know. But basically some politicians got together, they scribbled some words down on paper, and everybody has lost their mind. So thoughts and prayers go out to young Nick, and hopefully he will be okay. And we did see a proof of life from him a couple days, or I think it was yesterday maybe. We did see a proof of life, so there we have hopes that he will be okay and he will survive. So what happened? Well, according to some people on the internet, the world ended as we know it in Oregon because there is a new law that okays self-serve at rural Oregon gas stations. But will stations make the change? And this article comes from News 10. It was originally from the Associated Press, filed on Friday, December 29th, 2017. So this is a prediction of the, I don't know, the modern equivalent of Y2K, the Mayan calendar, everything all rolled into one. Just absolute anarchy breaking loose. From Bend, Oregon, gas stations in two central Oregon counties will continue to pump gas for customers despite a new law allowing self-serve gasoline in rural counties that takes effect in a few days. Employees at several stations in Crook and Jefferson counties said they are unaware of any plans to change to self-service, the bulletin reported. Others told the newspaper that they were unaware that the new law takes effect Monday, January 1st, 2018. Unaware of a new law. Wow, that's kind of strange. How could you not be aware of all of the new laws that go into effect each year? But anyway, Oregon is currently one of two states, the other being New Jersey, that does not allow customers to pump their gas. There's a lot of reasons that have been given for that, and I'll go into those in a little bit. A law passed by the legislature in May and signed into law by Governor Kate Brown in June will allow Oregon counties with 40,000 residents or less to deviate from that. Some station managers told the paper Thursday that their attendants would continue servicing patrons' cars just as it has done since 1951. Ah, the good old days. Our regular longtime customers love coming here and talking to us while we pump their gas, said Shelby Perkins, a cashier at a 76 gas station in Prineville. She added that wasn't sure regular customers even know how to operate the pumps. How can you not know how to operate a gas pump? This is absolutely nuts. Oh, gosh. I don't even know. Some of the articles that have been out there have just been really, really crazy. But anyway, Darlene Force, state manager at Main Station Express in Prineville, Justin Biederman, owner of the Metolius Market in Metolius, said they will continue relying on attendants since their stations are not equipped for self-service. My equipment is not set up for credit cards, he said, so we don't have any way of recording the gallons. The Culver Shell and Feed in Prineville is part of the handful of gas stations that are ready for self-service, said owner Jeffrey Honeywell Thursday. We're going to take advantage of it, he said. His gas station had changed to sundown to sunup self-serve gas when the state legalized it in 2015. There will be someone available to assist customers, Honeywell said. So, essentially, out in Oregon, for some reason or another, a long time ago, it was determined that The common man would not be able to pump his own gas. And there have been, I think I've heard people talk about that. There's required training that's mandatory that has to be done, and that you have to have certain qualifications and maybe even a certificate. I'm not sure about licensing, but it's just not something that a regular person can do. But when they posted this article on their Facebook page, there was a picture, and it had a it was asking thumbs up, thumbs down. What do you think about this? Should this be allowed? What should happen? And there were a number of different comments on there, and I think for the most part, a lot of them were sane. I think there were a few that fall in the lowest common denominator category that were just absolutely off the wall. I call those the whining ones. And one of them was, no, disabled seniors, people with young children in the car need help. Not to mention getting out of your car with transients around and not feeling safe, too. This is a very bad idea. Grr. In Michigan, when I was a kid, they still had the full service. So you had the attendant that would come over there and fill up the gas tank, clean the windows, check the oil and air and all that other stuff. And that was kind of neat. By the time I started driving, that was gone. So probably in the early to mid 80s, that disappeared and it started going over to self-service. But the one thing that I do remember when the change did happen and is to this day, I'm pretty sure that if there's somebody that's disabled, not able to go and handle their own fuel, the attendant will go outside and pump the gas for them. So it's not like they're going to be thrown out in the streets to fend for themselves. Next person, and when I divided these up, I was trying to get the ones that I knew were not trolling. I'm pretty sure that this one isn't trolling. I don't even know how to pump gas. I'm 62, native Oregonian. I say no thanks, and I don't want to smell like gasoline. So I guess it's not just the millennials that will have the reputation of being helpless and just distraught at everything. Next up, I'm in Colorado, where we are forced to pump our own gas because I'm worried about my children being left in the car while I stand outside of it in my skirt. I just pay the transients to pump it for me. This way we're all safe and the transients are distracted from bothering those who are pumping their own gas. I've lived in the state all my life and I refuse to pump my own gas. I had to do it once in California while visiting my brother and almost died doing it. This is a service only qualified people should perform. I will literally park at the pump and wait until somebody pumps my gas. I can't even. Well, maybe that one might be a little bit trolly, but who knows, maybe. Not a good idea. There are lots of reasons to have an attendant helping. One is they need a job too. Many people are not capable of knowing how to pump gas and the hazards of not doing it correctly. Besides, I don't want to go to work smelling of gas when I get it on my hands or clothes. I agree. Very bad idea. How do you wind up smelling like gas? I don't know. This is a little bit nuts. Yuck, pumping my own fuel in freezing temperatures and handling a nasty old fuel nozzle that 50 other people have touched that day. And who knows what cooties are on there. No, thank you. It's nice to not have to pump your own fuel. So that was pretty much the serious objections to it. Now, the trolling responses, this is what I really enjoyed. From the comments, I'm genuinely concerned for the gas station attendants. How many are robbed, killed, maimed, or acquire infectious diseases every year? Clearly, these guys are the real heroes, laughing in the face of danger just to make sure you get fueled up. Whatever they make currently, it needs to be doubled. Well, Oregon is one of those states that usually gets behind the fight for 15 nonsense, so who knows. Should people be allowed to do something so simple that everyone else in the world already does it? Or should the state fine, kidnap, and cage people over putting a nozzle in a hole and pulling a lever all by yourself? It's like those people in infomercials who can't perform menial tasks. Do you have trouble pumping your own gas? We have the state for you. It's Oregon. And when I saw that, I just envisioned somebody trying to put the credit, slide their credit card through the slider thingy, and they bend it, they break the card, they can't get it in there. They pull the nozzle out and spray gasoline in their face and shoot it all over the place. They go to put the nozzle into the gas cap area and they completely miss and just put like a big giant scratch down the side of their vehicle. And it's, oh my God. And I have a very soft spot in my heart for those people in the infomercials. It's like, what is wrong with you? But anyway, this explains why I never see an Oregon plate this far east, and hence we never finish the license plate game. They're all sitting at a pump in Idaho waiting for fuel. In West Virginia, we can order food while we pump our gas. With some practice and perseverance, you too can achieve the dream. There was only one service station in the area where I lived, and I had to drive 25 minutes to get there. Pumped my own gas my whole life, and now my hands have literally melted down to my wrists. I'm typing this with my tongue. If your only marketable job skill is being able to pump gas, by God, move to Oregon, and you will have reached the promised land. Well, don't forget about New Jersey, because they still don't allow people to pump their own gas. Another person with the entrepreneurial spirit. I've decided to move to Oregon to open up a school to teach people how to pump their own gas. Short-term business, you say? Ha! I will simply branch out and offer classes on such complicated things as 1. Tying your own shoes. 2. Dressing yourself. 3. Operating a self-checkout machine. 4. Dial your own phone. 5. Mow your own lawn. 6. Split your own firewood. 7. How to feed yourself. 8. Make your own dinner. 9. Wash, dry, and fold your own laundry. Extra charge as these 3 classes are taught separately. 10. Operating a can opener, manual and electric. Counting past 10. Wiping your own butt. And we will be back after this trip to the market. The self-serve market.
Listening to Freedom Fiends with Michael Dean and some of his weird friends. And yes, we're broadcasting this into space.
Are you a political activist who does things that the government might not like? Then this free ebook may save your life. Rats is your guide to protecting yourself against snitches, informers, informants, agents provocateur, narcs, finks, and similar vermin. Rats was written by OG libertarian Claire Wolf. Rats is a short book, easy to read, and available free in many formats. Download Rats free at rats-nosnitch.com. That's rats-nosnitch.com.
Freedom Fiends. And I am back. And I'm talking about a story from Oregon. You may have heard about it. People are freaking out because some of the rural gas stations will now be going with some self-serve options. It's not everybody. It's not mandatory. The impression that you would get from the panic and hysteria of it is that there will be no more there will be no more full service anywhere in the state of Oregon. It doesn't matter where. If you're handicapped, you're just out of luck. You're gonna have to pump your own gas. Nobody cares. All the attendants have been taken away to re-education camps to where they'll learn how to be maybe elevator operators or something like that, or doormen or greeters at Walmart, because they'll no longer be in this job of being an attendant at the gas station. No, that's not the case. In the major cities of Portland, I think it's still going to be mandatory that somebody go pump your gas for you, that you're not allowed to because maybe you can't be trusted. But anyway, the comments, the article that I had just read from, I think it's TVLA, Channel 10 out there, and they asked what people thought in the comments on there. Some of them were just absolutely insane, just out of this world, panic stricken. And of course, he had some of the regular comments of like, yeah, I think this is a good idea, or gee, on a really cold, crappy weather day, I'd like to have somebody come pump my gas for me. And you know what? Being in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, being in Bear Saskatchewan, I can relate to that. That's cool. But the people that are freaking out, oh my gosh, it's unbelievable. But my favorite are the trolls, and the memes that have been spawned from this are just absolutely unbelievable. I posted one on there. It showed a city burning in the distance. I don't know if it was forest fires or some sort of dystopian world coming to an end, whatever. But it showed a city burning off in the distance, and the caption was, 2 days after Oregon start pumping their own gas. And it got picked up in a couple of articles that were written specifically to talk about the outrage in the crazy comments on the original article. So it got picked up on a couple of internet website articles. It got screen capped, and then also there were a number of the different comments. Some of them I just read to you, and it turned into a whole cottage industry of documenting the outrage and the craziness. I like to call this the internet strikes back. When somebody does something silly and people on the internet just say, you know what, knock it off, you can't do that crazy stuff, we're not going to tolerate it, I call that the internet strikes back. A couple more of the comments that we had here I didn't get to in the last segment. I understand, Oregon, adulting is hard, and sometimes you have to have someone show you how. I'm here for you. Somebody else, I'll never forget the first time I had to pump my own gas. I had to fight off a bear that was standing in front of the pump. Oh no. Then I endured a hail of bullets from enemy sniper fire while trying to swipe my card. When I pulled the pump handle from the docking station, it set off a series of booby traps, and the next thing I knew, I was in my own version of Tomb Raider. Once I was done, a group of transies chased me in a tactical helicopter for miles because they wanted my tank of gas for making Nazi meth. Ooh, I like that one. You Oregonians had it so easy. But they had to give it up. So, to the people out there that do the difficult job, and I mean you, the attendants, thank you for your full service. And to those of you scoffers out there that all you can do is criticize these attendants, well, the next time your gas tank is on empty, call a crackhead. Support the thin fuel line. And interesting thing, though, about Oregon, being in the Pacific Northwest, was part of the frontier. It was part of the rugged America back in the 1800s. It was the unsettled land where people headed west to go find new adventure. And the heading west, I don't know what it is about heading west, but through the centuries, people have always headed west. If you go back to the 1600s, you had people heading over to the New World from Europe. And then you had settlers that were heading west after the United States was founded. I don't know if they just wanted to see where the sun goes, but they headed west. And we'll be back.
You and the hamster in your brain are listening to Freedom Fiends with Michael Dean and his weird friends. Gun Training with the Non-Aggression Principle, Volume 1. Basic Handgun and Rifle with Jared Waltz.
First rule of being alive is you own yourself.
A groundbreaking approach to firearms and self-defense training. Beautifully filmed and easy to understand instructions make this one a must-have. Gun Training with the Non-Aggression Principle, Volume 1. New DVD from Michael W. Dean, available on Amazon.
Your house is your property.
Beings. And I am back. This is Lou, and just got done talking about Oregon in the Gasapalooza, the Oregon
Ormageddon, whatever you want to call it out there. And I have it on very shifty authority that you can use your cell 411 app to create a network to bring your friends together to help you pump your gas if you can't get it. Not a guarantee. Anyway, back to the next story. I started talking about people heading west through the centuries. If you look at just in American history, you had the Puritans coming here in the, I believe, the 1500s, 15 or 1600s. But you also had explorers that came, Columbus, 1492, Vikings. Not even sure what year that was, but that, a couple hundred years before that. So people have explored, and I was thinking about one time when driving, and it's kind of corny, but the romantic notion of following the sun to see where it goes at the end of the day really struck me. I know it's complete nonsense, but I felt really good about it. It gave me the warm and fuzzy feeling. But if you look at why people have moved, here's the question. When you're going to a new territory, when you're going to a, dare I say, an undiscovered territory, a land that is unsettled, it hasn't been touched, you don't have gas station attendants to fill up your wagon for you, you don't have Holiday Inn to sleep at night, you don't have all these different things that a traveler would take for granted today. You just have wilderness. You don't even have roads. Why would somebody go out there? Why would somebody leave the security of their home and go out into the wild like that? Because God only knows what's out there. I mean, there might be transients. There may be bandits and all sorts of different perils out there. So why do they do it? Well, for some people, it's a sense of adventure. It's a sense of trying something new. It's doing something that perhaps they would not do in their lifetime, and most people wouldn't do, because there's an awful lot of people that chose to stay back east when people were heading west of the Mississippi. There were a lot of people that chose to stay in Europe when others were crossing the Atlantic. So some of them were looking for freedom. Now, the Puritans, who were not good folks, those were the people that would burn witches. They would kill people for dancing. One story, and this is why I have an appreciation for the Quakers. There was a Quaker woman that was beaten, and the Puritans ripped her clothes off, as I recall the story going, because she had dressed immodestly. She was basically maybe showing a little bit too much ankle. So it's kind of like the early American Taliban with the Puritans, because they were extremists. They were the first ones to bring religious extremism and communism to the New World. But this Quaker woman, they had beaten her and taken her clothes from her. So the response was, the Quakers, they also got in trouble because they just didn't go to church enough for the Puritans. So the Quakers stripped down and they went marching up and down the walkways in the Puritan churches in the buff to teach them a lesson. And after they did that and really offended the sensibilities of the Puritans, they kind of laid off on it. So the Puritans came here. The story that we're told in school is they came here for religious freedom. And in some regards, that's a little bit true. They were not liked in England. People really couldn't stand them. They were very strongly disliked because of their strict religious views and interpretations and expecting other people to live according to their religious beliefs. So they came here to partially to escape persecution, but mostly to be free to persecute, to come over here and get their own little Taliban thing going and create their own little society. And if you look at the people that came to America from Europe, the explanation that I heard one time was it really started ringing bells after I thought about it for a minute. But the New World was founded by three different groups of people. You had religious extremists that were sick and tired of the heathens back in Europe. You had the rugged individualists that were sick and tired of all the collectivists back in Europe. And then you had the European collectivist heathens that came here to make the new world just like Europe. So in that regard, I don't think the new world had a really good chance. But one of the key things is people, even the Puritans that wanted to be free to persecute, they were going from freedom. They were going away from the safety and security of the government where they lived. They were, or the folks that headed west of the Mississippi, they were going away from the safety and security of the government back east, out into the unknown, out into the territory where there was no government. And they did it. And this is going to surprise a lot of you, because a lot of people have this idea of, well, there was no land left available, there were no jobs, you know, the Mexicans just snuck into colonial America and taken all the jobs away from everybody. No, that's not true. A good portion of them left the safety and security of the East to escape the Constitution and the new government that it had created. A lot of people don't know this, but in the founding generation, I'm talking about the days of George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, John Adams, and the like, the ones that are commonly referred to as the founding fathers, the people that led us Americans from bondage to the king, from being subservient to the crown, the same founding fathers that fought to give us freedom so that we could have representation with our taxation. Those founding fathers, a lot of people really couldn't stand them at the time. And the rhetoric that we get growing up is that they were these wise, Christ on earth type men, dare I say demigods, who at the worst may have had an ill thought, but never an ill action, because they have to be turned into these heroes. And quite frankly, they were politicians. They were the politicians of the time. And the notion that there was once a time where politicians were not power hungry, it's a dream. It's a mythology. It's the myth built to create these great men images. And it just wasn't like that. As an example, most people don't know, but in the founding generation, there were 3 tax rebellions. And didn't the founding fathers fight a rebellion against the crown over taxation? Well, the three tax rebellions started off with Shays' rebellion, and this was one of the motivations for the Constitution to get put into place and create a strong central government. Because it's not like anybody was lamenting the loss of no longer having a strong central authority to boss them around. No, people were just fine with it. And quite frankly, when the Constitution was introduced, it was extremely unpopular. But in Shays' Rebellion, you had people on the Massachusetts frontier. I know it's hard to think of Massachusetts being a frontier, but at the time it was very undeveloped. And there were people that were living out in the sticks of Massachusetts, and they didn't feel represented in the capital. The capital was over on the East Coast, and it wasn't in the center of the state like most of them are. So for them to travel to air their grievances, they had to go a lot further than everybody else. The frontier was sparsely populated. Or I should say it wasn't populated enough to get the type of representation that the East had. And the taxes that were laid down were very difficult for the people out on the frontier to afford. So they had the rebellion. It was more of a polite protest. I mean, there was far less violence than you would see in a week. You saw less violence in Shays' Rebellion than you would see in one day in Chicago on the weekend. So I mean, it was far from violent. As a matter of fact, it was rather orderly. It wasn't entirely different from a Tea Party protest today, except I don't know if they were walking around and waving the flags of the politicians that they were protesting during Shays' Rebellion. But anyway, you had that. And then after the Constitution was ratified, you had the Whiskey Rebellion in 1794. And in that case, it was kind of often more of a frontier area. It wasn't in the big city area. And those people felt that, like, they were getting their chain yanked. They felt they weren't being represented that they were just being used as milk cows for the government. And that one, a little bit more violent. Not overly violent, but a little bit more violent. And they protested and rebelled against the father of our country. You know, the one of the founding fathers, they rebelled against the Constitution. And also you have Fry's Rebellion, which I've just learned about in 1799 it was. Yeah, 1799 to 1800. In this particular case, the background on this, when the quasi-war with France threatened to escalate in 1798, Congress raised a large army and enlarged the navy. To pay for it, Congress, in July 1798, imposed $2 million in new taxes on real estate and slaves, apportioned among the states according to the requirements of the Constitution. It was the first and only such federal tax. Congress had also recently passed the Alien and Sedition Acts, criminalizing dissent and increasing the power of the executive branch under John Adams. Criminalizing dissent. Isn't that the sort of thing that's supposed to happen in North Korea? So here we have the founding generation, these men that love peace and freedom more than they loved life itself, more than they love power, are criminalizing dissent and increasing the power of the executive branch. Hey, I thought only Trump and Obama did that. Just kidding. So you can see why people would head west. I think it was Daniel Boone, possibly. He was getting fed up with things over in the east, and he said, "To hell with y'all, I'm going to Texas." And he did go to Texas. And many people went to other places. We'll be back.
You're listening to Freedom Fiends with Michael Dean and his weird friends, tasing you with liberty since 2011. Learn more at freedomfiends.com.
Starving in the Company of Beautiful Women is Michael W. Dean's novel from the year 2000. It's entirely fictional.
Allegedly.
Starving in the Company of Beautiful Women is a glorious story about a low-rent post-punk rock star, Cash Newman. Cash Newman is entirely made up.
Not a guarantee.
And is not based on any particular person.
Not a guarantee.
Cash Newman has lots of fun with strange ladies and with the party favors.
Don't try this at home.
And he hangs out with people who commit 3 felonies a page.
But that's none of my business.
It's all in good fun. And at the same time, it's kind of deep. But always spunky. Michael recently updated the book to a much better version. He released it as a paperback, and for the first time, on Kindle. As with this and all Freedom Fiends-related things, please rate and review. Get Starving in the Company of Beautiful Women now on Amazon or at michaelwdean.com.
For entertainment purposes only.
Fiends. This is Lou, and we're talking about heading west. So many, many years ago, people left the safety and security of the cities of civilization, and they headed out into the unknown, into the wild, and they built something. They built the frontier. They settled the frontier. They built cities, which expanded. Well, first of all, they started with camps. Then it turned into towns and villages. And then it became the cities that we know today, out in the West, out in California, out in Oregon, even Nevada, all these different places. People went out there and they started with nothing and created something. Some of them failed. Some of them were successful. Some of them were very successful. But they did it. They went out there. They took a chance. Why? Well, the article that I'm going to be going over for probably the rest of the show is called The American West, A Heritage of Peace. It's by Ryan McMakin. And it's very similar to, there's one called The Not-So-Wild Wild West by Terry Anderson. An experiment in American anarcho-capitalism, if I recall. So I'm going to be referencing the the American West article primarily, but I'm going to be going by memory from the Not So Wild Wild West. The Not So Wild Wild West was a real eye opener to me, because if you get your history lessons from Hollywood movies and dime novels, you would think that everything was just absolute pandemonium out there. You'd have people out in what is now modern day Los Angeles going past each other in their horse-drawn wagons doing drive-by shootings at people's tar paper shacks out in the mining camps. It wasn't like that at all. It was actually a snooze fest. It was actually kind of boring, and it was peaceful, hence the title, A Heritage of Peace. A century ago, the American West, in the process of homesteading and Americanization that took place in the lands west of the Mississippi River, was seen as a triumph of American drive, ingenuity, and courage, a sheer act of will that required hard work, perseverance, and above all, a spirit of independence and individualism. These were the people that would take risks, and a lot of them did it for economic reasons. Economics would be probably the driving force. A lot of people have the impression that the person that went west was the mountain man, the Jeremiah Johnson type, who, if you've seen that movie at the very beginning of it, he's getting off a boat on a river, I'm assuming somewhere near the Rocky Mountains, and he's still in his Union military uniform from the Civil War, and he's had enough of people. He doesn't want a people anymore, so he goes up in the mountains and he wants to be a trapper. So the people that headed west, some of them want to be mountain men. Some of them were trappers that would go out and collect the furs and pelts and bring those back. Many of them were gold miners. Some of them were ranchers. Some of them were merchants, and they would go out and they would sell to the people that were mining and ranching and all these other different things. So economics was a great driving force, but why would people head out there? Didn't they have economy in the East? Well, they had a restricted economy. And eventually those restrictions came to the West, as you'll hear as we go on. But in the beginning, it wasn't like that. It was raw. It was free. In the decades following the closing of the frontier, as pronounced by Frederick Turner in 1890, this perception of the West changed dramatically. The old view of divinely inspired spread of Americanism changed to a more ambivalent view by mid-century, and finally to an openly hostile view today that Western society was and is violent, murderous, and chaotic. We are now told that the West, after the coming of the white man, was a land of sadistic Indian murderers and psychopathic outlaws and misfits who had abandoned the more peaceful life back in the good old civilized U.S. of A. And nothing could be further from the truth. I'll be back in the second hour, and we're going to dispel these myths and get to some real history.
Cell 411 is a great free app for Android and iPhone. It allows you to set up public and private cells for dealing with crime, emergencies, setting up neighborhood watch, activism, and even protecting your kids from bullies on the street or at school. Cell 411 gives your cells turn-by-turn directions to your location with one touch on your phone. There is also a Bluetooth panic button available that can be worn on your wrist, belt, or around your neck. Cell 411 has real-time chat for each alert so you can discuss the incident with family or friends in real-time video streaming. The video is stored on Cell 411's servers so your evidence cannot be deleted if your phone is taken or destroyed. Cell 411 has decentralized ride sharing that allows for payment in any form, crypto, barter, silver, cash, etc. Cell 411 does not take a cut of your fare. Get Cell 411 free on Google Play and the iTunes Store, or go to getcell411.com. That's getcell411.com.
This is the Freedom Fiends, broadcasting through the Libertarian Reeducation Center's low orbit ion cannon high atop Financial Beast Plaza on the artificial satellite LibPair 2017 in the Alpha Centauri region. The Freedom Fiends is covered by a BIPCOT no government license. This allows reuse by anyone except governments. Learn more at BIPCOT.org. So I am Lou, and I am flying solo tonight. I'm pretending that I'm doing the show with Nick, and it shouldn't be too difficult because he's kind of quiet. He doesn't say a whole lot. Nick, as I mentioned at the beginning of the first hour, is caught in the Oregon or Oramageddon, which is I don't know how to describe it. Everybody losing their mind because some people may wind up pumping their own gas if they're out in a rural village of their version of Bear Saskatchewan. Somewhere along those lines. So, anyway. So, this hour, we're not talking about the people that are freaking out over pumping their own gas. We're talking about the people who looked adversity in the face and just went about their business. The article, once again, that I'm going to be reading from this hour and referencing is The American West, A Heritage of Peace. It's from Mises.org, and it's written by Ryan McMakin. I'll also be referring to an essay by Terry Anderson, and I'm going to be doing that one from memory. I don't have it up, and I didn't have time to do all the reading. It's a very long article. I would have loved to have taken notes on there, but I've read it enough times that the stuff that I cover, I'll do from memory. But yeah, it's surprisingly for a dry-ish academic article. It's pretty interesting, but I think that's based upon the idea of hearing something that was completely contrary to the indoctrination that I'd received growing up. The notion that the Wild West was wild and that it was violent and gunfights all day, every day, all the time, and people just dying by the billions out there. And that couldn't be further from the truth. But anyway, whether promoting or condemning the West, though, novelists, filmmakers, and even historians never shied away from giving us many images of murdering Indians or roaming outlaws or crazy misfits. But what in an earlier era would have been abnormal behavior in films and images of the West became standard behavior for denizens of the West in later times. So much like much of history, the narrative has been changed. As an example, my understanding is that in the early years, the government schools would teach that Abraham Lincoln wasn't the great emancipator, and that slavery wasn't the real reason for the North to invade the South, and they would explain that the Emancipation Proclamation, when it said that the slaves were freed, it was only in the places where the Union troops did not have control. So they left slaves enslaved in the areas where they had the power to free them, and they declared them to be free in the areas where they had no power. And there were some slaves, possibly from a typo, that actually did get freed because basically a loophole. There was when the exceptions were listed, there were places that either got listed or didn't get listed. But anyway, so some of the slaves in the Union occupied area were set free. So I think it's about maybe 20,000 of them or so. But anyway, it was a tiny drop in the bucket, and I don't think that actually freeing slaves was the purpose of the Emancipation Proclamation. But anyway, that's something that's changed over the years. And when I went to school in the 70s, we didn't read the Emancipation Proclamation. We didn't read Lincoln's first inaugural address. So we didn't know about all these different things. So there was absolutely nothing to challenge the narrative, because we just had this bit of information spoon fed to us. He said, okay, this is what it is. Repeat it several times. Okay, good. You got it? All right, go live in and go believe that stuff. And I would find out later on that wasn't the case. Just like so many other things. And going back to the violence of the old West, the not so wild, wild West. But anyway, The article continues, much of this resolves around the treatment of Native Americans and other currently popular minority groups in film. And with the coming of films like Little Big Man, 1970, and Dances with Wolves, 1990, Americans have been treated to images of a bucolic, ideal world, disruptive by barbaric Americans who stripped the land and all of its people of everything that was good and decent, destroying not only the native peoples, but also themselves in the process. Well, I think it's pretty well documented that the military did do a heck of a job on disrupting the native peoples. They disrupted the living daylights out of them. Anyway, there's certainly no doubt that Native American tribes suffered greatly at the hands of government and quasi-government operations aimed at civilizing the West. But the unrelenting focus in recent years of these murderous exploits illustrates for us a larger agenda surrounding how we acquire modern perceptions of the American West. This agenda is one of convincing Americans that the American West was inherently violent, unusually unjust, and generally unfit for civilized human habitation. And this indictment now extends not merely to bands of conquering soldiers, but to the common settlers, fathers, husbands, and pretty much everybody else. A little side note here, I'm not trying to be conspiratorial, but there are many people out there that believe that without government, without a large, omnipotent, omniscient government guiding us, controlling us, and making sure that everything works just fine. That, by the way, it's a socialistic belief in central planning and control. So people that say, well, I just want the president to run the country and keep the economy going. Yeah, that's socialism because central planning. But these people have this belief that without government, without this tiny group of people that have given themselves titles, who are, by the way, they're not any more wise, virtuous, or knowledgeable than anybody else. They're just people that were able to trick enough people into voting for them. And votes don't bestow capability or wisdom or virtue or knowledge. None of that stuff. So, anyway, without these people, we would just be suffering. We would just be killing each other. We would just be standing at a gas pump waiting for somebody to come along and pump our gas for us because we couldn't do it on our own. And I think that a lot of people really promote that agenda. So they try to find ways of framing a narrative, of creating a story that supports that. And a lot of times they're making this stuff up on the fly. They're just pulling it out of their hats. It's not real. They have no basis of it. They're just coming up with it and making it up as they go along. And they don't care because the noble lie, it's for the greater good. It's to promote our government, is to promote the state. So, yeah, why not? Let's just make stuff up, because in the end, people are going to believe. And isn't that what's important? So, consider the 1992 film Unforgiven, sometimes called the Unwestern. This film portrays the West as a place of capricious violence and chaos, where law and order is regularly undone by crooked sheriffs, vengeful bounty hunters, and abusive cowpokes. Interestingly enough, that movie, Unforgiven, with Clint Eastwood, it wasn't the typical shoot-'em-up Western. When it came out, I saw it with my father, and he described it as an adult Western, a grown-up Western, to where they're actually talking about ideas versus just having shootouts every couple scenes. But anyway, in recent years, this image of the West as a home of unusually sadistic and frequent violence has been an ever more popular topic of research on the West, which, with typical additions being Glenda Riley's A Place to Grow, Women in the American West, and Claire V. McKenna's Homicide, Race, and Justice in the American West, 1880 to 1920. Both of these works build on the violent image of the West already provided in Hollywood movies while providing a realistic revisionist picture of non-heroic violence perpetuated by drunks and the gun culture. Little side note here, with Hollywood, I had mentioned that they have a vested interest, or they perceive a vested interest in seeing people embrace statism and feel the need for government and protection and everything else. But quite frankly, who's gonna spend $8.50 to go watch a movie about people raising cattle, tending crops, panning for gold, and just going about their business peacefully? That's not the thing people go to the movies for. Same with dime novels. Who's going to read a book about somebody doing their farming and not shooting anybody? It's not what people buy these things for. So the myth of the brutal frontier, the assumption that violence has more often than not been a central reality of frontier life, has long been popular. How we see the violence, though, and whether or not the violence is heroic or just meaningless and tragic, has depended on just who is writing the screenplays or doing the research. The latter point was made recently by William Handley in his book Marriage, Violence, and the Nation in the American Literary West. Handley notes that violence has always been an inherent part of literature and film about the West. The difference between the modern variety of violence and the older variety, however, is that while newer descriptions of violence in the West are intended to highlight the victimization of a wide variety of groups, the violence of earlier authors like Willa Cather and Zane Grey was intended to illustrate the necessity of violence in establishing civilization in a wild and untamed land. Of course, with the rise of postmodernism in the 1960s, traditional rationales for the settlement of the West lost almost all of their defenders. The last 30 years or so have been bad decades for the reputation of the West. Regarding the just use of violence, if you have, and this was not a common occurrence, but if you have robbers coming into town, hooligans and stuff like that, and you have to defend yourself, the pacifist will say, no, give them a hug, talk to them, talk your way out of it. But sometimes justice comes from the barrel of a gun, and that's what keeps the peace. We'll be back.
You're listening to Freedom Fiends. Go to freedomfiends.com to help keep it drone-proof.
The Central Scrutinizer is a Soviet-style Leviathan trying to keep track of all you do. That's why I use a VPN, or virtual private network, from Bola VPN. Bola VPN is inexpensive, secure, and will allow you to use your computer without leaving a trail. Bola VPN is now also offering torrent seed boxes for safely sharing media with the world. And if you open a support ticket saying you heard about them from the Freedom Fiends, they'll add 3 extra days free. That's Bola VPN at BOLEHVPN.net.
This is Lou, and we're talking about the American West, a heritage of peace. The true story of the West, not what you see in the Hollywood movies and dime novels, not the violence and the drive-by wagon train shootings, but people going out and handling their business. So, getting back to the article, thus while the explanations for the violence changes over the decades, assumptions that violence was the general modus operandi of settlers on the frontier remained in full force. Yet since at least the 1970s, research has indicated that both camps may have been wrong about violence in the West. Excluding the Indian Wars of the mid to late 19th century, which were lopsided affairs conducted by the United States government, we find that the allegedly inherent violence of the West was not noticeably any greater than that of points east. Historian Richard Shankman largely attributes the legacy of those reliably violent Western films. Many more people have died in Hollywood Westerns than ever died on the real frontier. In the real Dodge City, for example, there were just 5 killings in 1878, and the most homicidal year in the little town's frontier history. Scarcely enough to sustain a typical 2-hour movie. Shankman was basing this comment on historian W. Eugene Howland's research, in which he notes that in many places like Dodge City, tales of violence were actually accentuated to appeal to the tourist trade in the latter years of the frontier. This is not difficult to understand, considering the movement made popular by promoters of the West Cure, of a fad much promoted by proto-yuppie Theodore Roosevelt, that claimed that a period of hunting and tough travel out west would make men more masculine. Howland reached these conclusions in 1976 with the publication of Frontier Violence, another look in which he explained, in which he examined a number of statistical indicators in order to determine the true level of violence in the American West. Historians have been working to refute his conclusions ever since, although the results have been less than conclusive. Adding to Howland's thesis, in 1983, Robert Dykstra published Cattle Towns, which included an examination of the violence in Kansas towns like Abilene, Wichita, and Caldwell. In novels and on the silver screen, these towns became known for their shootouts. But as Dykstra tells us, the reality was quite different. These cattle towns had an economic interest in ensuring as little violence as possible, and they delivered. Which Dodge City, yeah, Dodge City is the one that, that's the cattle town that Wyatt Earp was a sheriff in. And if memory serves me correctly, he was a sheriff there, or he was a lawman for at least 19 years before he went to Tombstone, and I believe it was in Dodge City, Kansas. And during that time at Dodge City, he'd never killed a man. I don't think he even ever shot a man as sheriff in 19 years. And until probably fairly recently, it was highly likely that a person could work in law enforcement and never fire their service weapon in the line of duty. I mean, they could do 25, 30 years and never have to fire their weapon. They might draw it, but it was very rare for somebody to fire it. But I think that's really changing a whole lot over the past couple of years. More recently, we find Lethal Imagination, Violence and Brutality in American History, edited by Michael Belisilis, the now infamous author of Arming America, which contains a number of essays by authors further examining the disappointing reality that the West was actually quite a bit more boring than the movies led us to believe. Indeed, taken together, this body of research leaves us with a West that hardly lives up to the reputation of the Wild West. And that's the reason for the name of that essay being The Not-So-Wild Wild West. As with Dodge City, the excitement in the Old West, in general, has been much overstated. All the big cattle towns of Kansas combined saw a total of 45 murders during the period of 1870 to 1885. 45 murders over a 15-year period for all those cities. Dodge City alone saw 15 people die violently from 1876 to 1885, an average of 1.5 per year. Wow, that doesn't sound too crazy. Deadwood, South Dakota, and Tombstone, Arizona, home of the OK Corral, during their worst years of violence, saw 4 or 5 murders respectively. Vigilante justice appears to have not been much worse. We'll be back.
You're listening to Freedom Fiends. So much truth, it hurts.
Hey, this is Nathan Explosion from Death Clock, and you're listening to Freedom Fiends on the radio. Worms.
And I am back. This is Lou. Freedom Fiends. I want to read this section again. All the big cattle towns of Kansas combined saw a total of 45 murders during the period of 1870 to 1885. Dodge City alone saw 15 people die violently from 1876 to 1885, an average of 1.5 per year. Deadwood, which a TV show was made off of, South Dakota, and Tombstone, Arizona, home of the OK Corral, during their worst years of violence, saw 4 and 5 murders respectively. Vigilante violence appears to not have been much worse. One of the things about the shootout at the OK Corral is, and it's being spoken about, gosh, what, maybe 150 years later? I can't remember what year it was, but it was quite a long time ago. And it became famous almost instantly, and it's still famous to this day. It's something that's still talked about. And most people aren't gonna figure out this answer, but why is it famous? Why is it talked about all these years later? Why was it talked about back then? Why did the news of it spread like wildfire? Well, quite frankly, the reason is because it was just so darn rare that would happen. That's why it was talked about. Nobody talks about the things that happen all day, every day. Nobody makes a big stink about it and writes books about it. They talk about and they write about things that are rare, things that hardly ever happen. That's what makes the news. You know, somebody going to work each day doesn't make the news, but a building burning down, it does. So, interestingly enough, and I'm going off the script here, reference. I think I got this from the other one, the Not So Wild Wild West, from 1850 to 1900, I believe it was. There were a total of 12 documented bank robberies west of the Mississippi. 12 documented bank robberies west of the Mississippi. Clint Eastwood probably took down more banks than that, just in the spaghetti westerns, but if you get your history from dime novels and Hollywood movies, you would think that banks were getting robbed all day, every day. As a matter of fact, you might have 2, 3, 4 robberies going on at the same time. You get these people in there, they're robbing the joint, and somebody else comes in, they're trying to rob it, then they're robbing each other. They're just passing the bank's money back and forth because there's just not enough banks for all these robbers. No, it wasn't like that. You didn't have all these bank robberies. As a matter of fact, I think that may have been Terry Anderson, but I remember reading about the researcher that found the information that showed the documentation of the number of bank robberies. In that particular year, in his hometown of Dayton, Ohio, there were more bank robberies than from 1850 to 1900. West of the Mississippi, there were more bank robberies in Dayton, Ohio, than half of the North American or half of the American territory, or what's currently the United States of America. One city had more bank robberies than all of that. So, no, it's not true. Now, vigilante violence. People say, but without police, then you would just have vigilantes out there, and they would just be grabbing people and convicting them on the spot and manufacturing evidence and, you know, all the same things that government police departments are being accused of right now. But here's the thing, vigilante, the root of that is vigilant. Many of the same people that say we need to have police and we can't have vigilantes are the same people that say we have to be vigilant against oppressive, tyrannical government. Vigilant, watching out for what's going on, taking action when necessary. So how did things go with the vigilantes? Were they just roaming gangs going around chasing people down and just lynching them left and right? According to Dijkstra and Richard M. Brown, while the Kansas Code gave mayors the power to call a vigilante group from all the men in the town who ranged in ages from 18 to 50, it seems at least in Kansas that it was rarely done. In a span of 38 years, Kansas only had only 19 vigilante movements that accounted for 18 deaths. In addition, 1876 and 1886, no one was lynched. Oh, between 1876 and 1886, no one was lynched or hanged illegally in Dodge City. So wait a minute, the vigilantes didn't go and grab people up and just lynch them and for no reason? Wow. Now, with Dodge City and other similar cattle towns, what are the cattle towns like? Well, you're going to have a fairly good sized population there, but you're also going to have cattle hands that come in off of the ranches every now and again. And it's not entirely different from military troops like around a base, Fort Campbell, Fort Bliss, Fort Bragg, any of these places. They come in out of the field. They've been working long hours. They haven't been able to enjoy themselves, and then they go to town. And they cut loose. They go to the bar. They get some beers. They gamble. They find women. They do the things that men do when they've been busting their hump for a month or two or three. They come to town. They got some money in their pocket, and they do things. So it's not different between the two. And that's what you have going on in there. And I mentioned earlier that there's an economic interest in keeping the peace. The guys coming into town, they don't want to get in fights and ruin their free time. They don't want to wind up in jail. They don't want to wind up dead. They're out to have a good time. Yeah, stuff's going to happen. With alcohol, there's going to be stupidity that goes along with it. It is what it is. But it's not the goal. They're not going out looking to stir up trouble. So the soldiers or the cattle hands have an interest in staying out of trouble, and the people of the town have an interest in preventing trouble. So it kind of works out. But anyway, given the money to be made by exploiting the exciting reputation of the frontier, it should not surprise us that Dodge City was hardly alone in manufacturing tales of blazing guns to attract men seeking adventure. Towns like Tombstone, Abilene, and Deadwood all played up their supposed histories of frontier violence. On closer inspection, though, the records are not nearly as exciting. For more, see the Not-So-Wild Wild West, which I was mentioning before. If the movies and novels about the West are so unreliable, then what can we learn from documented cases about real-life violence in the West? Certainly, a case that would have to jump out at us as a quintessential blood feud in the West would be the Lincoln County War of 1878 to 1881. As the name implies, the unpleasantness was quite disruptive to southern New Mexico. It provided quite its share of corpses. But even then, we find a body count intolerably low by Hollywood standards. Like many similar feuds on the frontier, the Lincoln County War began as a land dispute that turned violent, following a variety of unsavory actions taken by government authorities. The war was touched off by a legal dispute between established cattlemen L.G. Murphy and J.J. Dolan, who used their connections with U.S. officials in the area, as well as the Army at Fort Stanton, to secure economic control over the cattle and merchant economies of Lincoln County. In 1877, Alexander McSween and John Tunstall, along with competing cattlemen John Chisholm, began to challenge the control of Murphy and Dolan, as well as the favoritism that they had long been receiving from territorial officials. In turn, after being harassed and arrested at the request of a U.S. attorney, McSween was eventually legally outmaneuvered by Murphy and Dolan as they continued to call in government favors in order to ruin their new competition. Sheriff William Brady received a court order to seize property belonging to both McSween and his partner Tunstall. But on the way to the Tunstall Ranch, the sheriff's posse gunned down Tunstall in cold blood after he had surrendered his gun, setting off the most violent part of the war. Present at Tunstall's murder was a young man Tunstall had recently taken under his wing, William H. Bonney, alias Billy the Kid. The Kid swore to avenge Tunstall's death, and by 1881, after a gunfight at McSween's home, where the army was brought in against McSween and his men, and McSween's house was burned to the ground by the sheriff's men, Sheriff Brady, several deputies, McSween, and at least six of his men were killed, including Billy the Kid. Yet when the smoke cleared and the unusually smoke cleared from this unusually violent conflagration, the legend remains far more violent than the reality. After all, authorities have been able to prove that Billy the Kid, generally regarded as the most blood-soaked participant in the Lincoln County War, killed three people. Most agree that he could have killed as many as three or four more people. But considering the circumstances, it's difficult to ascertain how the kid managed to gain a reputation as a psychopathic killer, or how stories began to circulate of how he had killed 21 men by the time he was 21. I think it was Wild Bill Hickok, possibly. And I believe he's the one that was killed in Deadwood. But his reputation was that he had been shot 100-some times and killed just many, many, many men. And I think the discussion was, well, you know, maybe that was embellished just a little bit. Well, no kidding. I mean, if you get shot that many times, you're a number two pencil. But anyway, so yeah, a lot of embellishment going on there. Much of the confusion was due, as Richard Shankman indicates, to American movies. Films that depict the Lincoln County War, like Chisholm, 1970, which portrays Billy as a rather sympathetic character, and Young Guns, 1988, which makes Billy look a bit more crazy, plays up the violence for obvious reasons. However, even considering the rather alarming body count, by contemporary as well as modern standards, events like the Lincoln County War were hardly everyday occurrences. And in the end, those involved were corrupt officials and cowboys who didn't much care for having their friends gunned down by unscrupulous sheriff's deputies. So it looks like the history of justice is that you could always get justice if you can afford it. The politically connected have always been taken care of. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Freedom Fiends, and I'm beaming these words into your cerebellum.
Ever struggle for the right thing to say at a party? Want something to break the ice? Get the free Freedom Fiends Android app, Pocket Alibi. Pocket Alibi will help you have things to say. It'll replace verbal communication when you're not speaking with somebody.
I value your input.
It'll make you the hit of any party.
Not my circus, not my monkeys.
Will it work?
Not a guarantee.
It's a great icebreaker, too. Comes loaded with hundreds of original funny sayings with great voices and great recording quality. It's arranged into 7 categories. Disclaimers.
You should never do the thing I'm talking about.
Excuses.
I'm sorry, sir. An older girl told me to do it.
Advice. Fun too.
Get off me, kitty.
Libertarian pickup lines.
Hey, baby, hold my camera while I yell at this meter maid.
State speech is hate speech.
Bark, bark for the state.
Get Pocket Alibi today on Google Play for free. Again, search for Pocket Alibi. That's Pocket Alibi. A-L-I-B-I.
Pocket Alibi? Pocket Alibi? Pocket Alibi? Pocket Alibi? Pocket Alibi?
Does this app make me look fat?
Fiends. This is Lou in the final segment for the night, and we're talking about the American West, a heritage of peace. I just got done talking about the Lincoln County War, the story of Billy the Kid, how this translates into the frontier being essentially uncivilized and coming apart at the seams remains to be seen. For its part, at least, Chisholm did portray the struggle of the individual against the state and against outlaws, and does celebrate the self-reliant man, but the violence of the West contained in Chisholm, and in hundreds of pictures like it, has helped to burn an image of an inherently violent frontier into the minds of Americans, and in recent decades this image has now been turned from glorifying nationalism on the frontier to a new one of showing almost exclusively the frontier's horrors. Yeah, the most violence that happened on the frontier was when the military was going around and exterminating Indian tribes and kicking them off their land and putting them into concentration camps, I mean reservations. That was the real violence of the West. So I asked the question many times, and I've answered it a little bit. Why would people leave the safety and security of the East? Why would they go to an area with no roads, with no Holiday Inn, with no attendants to pump their gas for them to fill up their horse-drawn wagons? Why would they do this? Well, quite frankly, the story that I just talked about, the Lincoln County Wars, where the government was picking winners and losers. Well, actually, it was picking losers because that, you know, that they were forcing people to lose that should have been able to compete. You know, let people fail, rise or fail on their own. But when you have this collusion between government and private industry, that's called fascism. And it's not a new concept. It stems from in early America, going back to the British system of mercantilism. So it's nothing it's not something that just popped out during the New Deal or recently. No, this is something that's been going on the whole time. So why would people leave that behind? Because they know that they can get an honest shake going out and being in an area without government or with an absolute bare minimum of government. So how did they do this? This was talked about in the Not So Wild Wild West. Maybe I'll do another show on this sometime. People got together and they formed companies. They would get together and they would come up with a contract and they would head out west together. From, let's say, they started off in Boston and they wanted to go out to California, like when gold was discovered in 1849 and the gold rush started. That, and there was an entire industry about based on moving people from the east out to the west for them to go find their fortune. But they would get together and they would form up companies. So numerous people would agree to a contract and they would come up with a contract of what each person's responsibility was going to be, both work-wise or financially, what would be done if they run into particular situations, what the rules were if you had a particularly religious group. They may want to set up their own little religious rules to say that you can do this, but you can't do that. But quite frankly, if you have a bunch of religious people and they're the same religion, it doesn't seem like they would have to make up rules because they would already be in place. But anyway, they got together and they had voluntary contract. And the reason they did this was because it was treacherous. They were going up against unbelievable weather. They were going through the mountains, so they're dealing with snow and ice. They're going through deserts, so they're dealing with heat, scorpions, and rattlesnakes, and nothing else for miles and miles around. And that's not one of those things that you can do on your own. One of the biggest mistakes that people make is assuming that the individualist is a hermit. No, the individualist understands that cooperation is key and there are things that people cannot do on their own. The collectivist, on the other hand, says everybody needs to have somebody else there to help them, even if they don't need them, and they need to be forced to get help or to help others. And that's the whole thing about individualism versus collectivism. No force versus force. But anyway, that's how they did it. And maybe I'll talk more about this another time. But anyway, thanks for listening tonight. And for more Freedom Fiends, go to freedomfiends.com. Worms.